Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
And now,
it's time for
Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast.
Hi.
Hello. Hi, I'm Mike Sweeney.
I'm Jesse Gaskell.
We are both writers on The Conan Show, last we checked.
Yes, I hope so.
It changes
because I'm still working here.
Right. That would be horrible if you kept working here and didn't get a paycheck.
I know. But I do assume that that's what's going to happen one day. Just log in and my password will have been changed.
It's tough even getting a paycheck and working here sometimes. So no paycheck. Oh.
Yeah, Sweeney forgot his glasses today.
I did, sorry. My reading glasses.
So if he sounds different, that's why.
Yes, this is all carefully scripted. I'm reading from a script.
You just told me an interesting thing about your glasses.
Oh, I did? Yes.
They're prisoner glasses.
I went to this place in hip Silver Lake, and they're like, oh, man, we've got these cool frames that we bought. You know, they're surplus from a prison. It's like, sure, let's dial those up. And they're prison glasses because they have no metal in the frame.
So you people can't kill yourself.
Or others.
Yeah.
No shiv.
You can't Epstein yourself
exactly.
Or others.
No shiv. Unless you can, maybe you can sharpen a plastic to the point where you can harm people.
Anything can be a shiv. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're not in a prison. We're at a job that we like very much.
What a segue.
And this week, we have an interview that we did in New York.
Yes.
It's by popular demand. We've been sitting on this one.
We have.
It was hard to keep it under my butt cheeks because it's so hot.
Which is where we store all our interviews.
Yes.
when they're done. You really do it all on this show. Incredible.
I know. I'm like a hen and I'm mm-hmm. warming the interviews.
I know. We have to.
Before they hatch.
Otherwise, these tapes are destroyed if they're not kept at 98.6.
So this one has been appropriately warmed. It is Brian McCann.
Brian McCann. I'm going to use the term legendary writer.
Yes.
And performer on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, The Tonight Show, and also The Conan Show on TBS.
Yeah, and he's been in so many.
Oh, man.
Just an incredible performer.
Brilliant performer.
Tons of characters.
Brilliant writer.
Tons of ass shots.
Yes. When he left the show, we thought, well, we might just have to fold our tent and go home.
Yeah.
without McCann around. But
yeah, we had a nice conversation with him.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is. We've got another historic, legendary Conan writer with us.
We sure do.
Yeah. This is a big one.
This is a big one. It's Brian McCann.
Brian McCann.
Hi.
Your portrait still hangs in the hallway.
It does.
I am very flattered by that.
Yeah.
I really am.
In our office, it's a mm-hmm. giant portrait of you with your years working.
It implies
on the show.
That you are dead, though.
It
because
does.
There's sort of, yeah.
Yes.
Which may not be completely that far off.
I think that helps burnish your legend.
Yes.
I will say at least like six times a year or once every 2 months, if you do the math. Someone texts me a picture like, I'm at Conoco and look at this. And
yeah.
That's your picture. And I always have to be like, wait, what?
Yikes.
That's crazy.
That's wow.
Even though I helped hang it. That's nice.
But it also shows you how rarely we redecorate.
Yeah. No, that's true. But I do, is there any other picture of any other writer that is hung with such just, you know, center focus?
It is.
I think it's the only one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we're lowballing it. You mm-hmm. walk up the center staircase towards our lobby, and there's a landing.
It's giant. It's in a gilded frame.
Yes.
It's got to be at least four foot by 3 foot. Mm-hmm. It's a large picture.
It's fantastic. It's a fake daguerreotype. I think, because you were playing a...
Look it up, folks.
Folks, we use some really big words, French words on this show.
We don't dumb it down for you, because...
No way.
We couldn't afford daguerreotypes, so we faked it.
I know the other shows use real daguerreotypes, but not us. We're on a cable channel, so...
But so what were the years that you were there?
With...
By there, I also mean here.
95?
Yeah. 95. Yes, near the Christmas time.
Yep. I started in November. And then if you go 17 years after that,
okay. mm-hmm.
I left in August.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't remember exactly the year I left, but it was 17
Around
years after 95.
2012.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That seems a little early.
That does seem early. I don't know why Jesse's trying to... diminish your legacy.
Or challenge my math.
Unless it was, maybe it was 2013, but
I'm
in
so
August.
Bad at math, I'm not even.
Well, I think 2013 might make more sense.
Okay.
Well, it's your life. Why
right.
should?
Right.
We know exactly.
We'll leave it for the biographers.
Yeah.
I wish I really honestly don't know.
Okay.
All right.
I live life
I like that
differently, I suppose. I don't know. I don't have, like, because nothing happened as soon as I left. I did a road trip, and then I hung out, and then I started doing something like the following January or
mm-hmm. right
and none of those are connected to me to years. Like, I don't measure things, I guess, in years of, you know, this was the, you know, 2015, whoo, what a year.
Right. No.
But I missed you there, and I started in early 2014, so I know that you were gone.
Well, 2013 then. Sounds right, but, you know, here's a little challenge to the listeners.
What if Brian avoided you for a year while he was working?
Oh, that's possible.
What's the challenge to the listeners?
What year did I leave?
Brian's giving you all the statistics
all the clues,
you need.
Yeah.
First one to
you
write a postcard and send it in with the correct date. It
has to be a postcard.
It has to be a postcard.
And we don't have an address. So that's a further challenge.
Yeah.
But good luck. Good luck to you listeners.
But anyway, it was a remarkable gig to have. So you've been there since 2014.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
It's nowhere near 17 years, but.
No. We it's so funny. We talked to Stack.
Oh.
Who, believe it or not, remembers exact dates for everything.
Yeah.
But he's amazing.
He's amazing.
And he always, like, he remembers...
Brian Stack.
Remembers every single intern's name.
Yes.
And I do not. And so, like, and I would say to him, like, oh, like, who is that? Like, I have such trouble remembering names. And he'd be like, yeah, me too. And then he knows every single one of them. So I think he sympathizes and he tries to make it seem
he doesn't want you to feel bad about...
Right. But then, you feel bad because then he's shaking hands and asking about their dogs and stuff like
right.
that.
Right. Then he deliberately tries to show you up in front of former interns. It's a classic Stack move. Classic. But he was just talking about all the stuff that, like, I think you were the king of coming up with stuff in the writer's room.
In the room.
Right.
And...
That's right, I was.
Yeah. Mike, finally you've said something accurate.
Thank you.
Thanks for the acknowledgement. That would end, like, it was literally...
Just doing... Yeah,
let's put this on the show tomorrow.
Messing around, right. And then now that's a character that's going
I think
on the
that's
show.
When I'm most productive is in those situations. And then, like, the productivity goes way down when they're like, well, now go to your desk and type up 10 beats.
Oh, yeah, right.
And you're like, ugh.
No, but that's the weird thing about writer's rooms is that people are really quiet and kind of introverted in the writer's room. And then there's some who just kind of, it's like, oh, I got this group here I can make laugh.
It's a total playground.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you would grab what it was, like, we were just talking about the FedEx Pope, which is still one of my favorite characters. But
Which was, yeah, ridiculous that that got on. And then someone like, I mean, fans liked the FedEx boat.
I always loved the FedEx.
And the story of its birth is just so lame. It's just me putting on a FedEx box and just going, I'm the FedEx boat, and people laughing.
And you were really resourceful working with the materials you had.
Yeah. It's true.
Preparation H. Raymond was simply because Preparation H sent a huge, like, box of Preparation H.
Yeah, we couldn't remember. I was trying to remember. Did we do a joke about it?
No, it was just one of those things where companies.
They just knew that we have hemorrhoids.
You know how companies just send the show, or at least they did. They just send the show stuff, hoping you're going to use it. Except Preparation H did not like the way that we used it, which is just me as a bucktooth freak man passing it out.
With giant ears.
With giant ears. Well, that was the freak man. Part.
And singing.
And singing.
About their product. I don't know what's and then not to like.
We asked if Preparation H Raymond could go tour the Preparation H facilities, and they did not even respond.
Right. We wanted to do a remote.
That was going
to
be my first solo remote.
Oh, like Preparation H is getting tons of other offers? That's not...
Right?
I can't even think of the last time I saw
We were irate. I remember we're like, what's wrong with them? Why would they let this character into their facility?
But they send it to a show, and then the show willingly just makes this long-running bit about their product. I do remember... we did a week of shows in Toronto.
Right.
And Preparation H, Raymond was there. And Preparation H comes in those long boxes, you know, kind of boxes, and then inside the box is a tube. So it's a weighty box, and I was whipping those boxes into the crowd.
Right. That was part of your character, would carry a basket and whip preparation actual samples to people.
Yeah, whip like the actual product. And it hits someone in the eye. And so, like, there was, like, an injury, and it became a headline, like, on page 7 of the Toronto Times or whatever.
Really?
The next day, and it was a picture of me, and it said, Preparation H. Raymond rubs everyone the wrong way. And it talked about someone's eye injury.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
So you had to, did we send you back early across the lines back to the States?
I got rolled up in a rug and just smuggled back to safety.
Because there's also an incident with Triumph up in Toronto because he made fun of Quebec, French, you know, the province.
Don't mess with Quebec.
Man, did they. There was backlash. There were angry speeches in Parliament in Ottawa.
In French.
Yeah, and Conan had to apologize.
Yeah, well, that was like the last show because I remember I was at the airport early the following day, and that was all over the papers.
Their tabloids.
Yeah.
The front page.
Oh, wow.
And like, I felt like we were getting out just like on the last helicopter.
It was scary.
Is that why we haven't been back to Canada?
I don't know, maybe.
A little bit.
The week was going great other than this eye injury, which I don't even remember. Yeah. But, and then the the next to last night was this snafu with one-tenth of their country.
But nonetheless, Preparation H. Raymond was a classic.
It was. Yeah. Whether you lose an eye or not, you're going to love this friendly purveyor of Prep H.
That one-eyed person has a story to tell the grandkids.
What a tale. And a clipping, page 7 clipping.
Yeah.
I think I was so embarrassed. Like, I didn't even save that clipping.
Right.
And that's usually something I revel in is personal failures. Right. It's like, look what I failed at.
But I failed this good. Yeah.
Yeah. My failure got a headline.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, I was like, didn't want to. I don't know. Now, here I'm talking about it 15 years later.
Sure.
But for whatever reason, I didn't want to memorialize that.
Well, it's upsetting. I assume.
Yeah.
Some level. I'm sure that person's okay.
Well, Brian, I don't know you very well, and I'd love to hear about your background. How did you come to Conan? I mean, what were you doing before that?
I was just doing, back in the early 90s, it was really only one road. It was you go out and do stand-up. This was before the blogs and the YouTube clips.
Podcast.
So you just, you went out and did stand-up, and I was solely Chicago-based. I didn't have a car. So I wasn't a comic that, like, even went to DeKalb, which is outside Chicago. Yeah, I just, like, I did clubs in Chicago. And then I did a lot of improv. And a lot of these clubs had improv teams, and I was always on those improv teams and stuff. So I was actually able, and then I had a radio show in Chicago too, which came out of just that exposure of those clubs. So I was able to have like a really good situation in Chicago, and I knew Andy very well, mm-hmm. and Andy got brought in, and then I think he was always kind of a little bird in Conan's ear, like, bring McCann kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that wore him down after a couple of years. And he needed someone to injure people's eyes. the call was made.
Yeah.
But it was really just when I graduated from college in 87, and I just immersed myself in the Chicago improv scene mm-hmm. for like 5 solid years. Mm-hmm. I had no dreams of doing anything else. I had no like even concept in my head that I could write for television or anything.
You didn't have a plan. You just loved doing it.
I just loved doing it. And like my plan was maybe I'll buy a theater. Right. Maybe I'll have my own improv.
With a bar.
Yeah. Right. Like literally that was the thing. And then I was just like when Andy got pulled in to do late night, I was like, oh, wait. Like, I was just so dumb.
My friend's got a good job.
Oh, wait, I guess I could apply to work on a show. Like, I was just really enjoying the party. It was post-college. I was doing something. I found something that I just totally loved. I was, mm-hmm. like, excelling at to a certain degree. And, life was good. So I wasn't looking to rock the boat, but I also didn't have dreams. Other than I just wanted to make people laugh that night,
right?
Kind of thing. That was it.
Sounds like a good life.
Yeah. That sounds like you were in the moment. But you were unusual too. People would point out that I think it was unusual that you were really doing great as a stand-up, but you were also involved in improv. Like a lot of times, people are like, "Well, I'm an improver. I could never do stand-up," mm-hmm. or vice versa.
Yeah.
So I think that is cool.
I don't know if that's so unique now anymore, but it was very unique at the time. Like, it was because in the 80s and 90s, like, they were almost rival worlds. Like, they really, really looked down upon one another.
They were like the Jets and the Sharks. They really,
they really were.
They would shit on each other. It was hilarious. Crazy.
It was ridiculous.
It was silly.
And I was the, the ambassador.
Right. Oh.
To bridge both those sides.
You would shit on both.
We all suck.
They both blow.
No, but I would, I started, falling in love with, stand-ups, and I would bring my improv buddies to go see certain stand-ups, especially like Bill Hicks and stuff, and then people got blown away. And then I think through that gesture, I don't know if it was that, but it was just it definitely softened.
Did it soften people?
Within my improv crew, people would be like, oh my God, that truly inspiring. And you're actually watching art. You're not watching an improviser's view of what stand-up was back then was – there was only one type, and it was hack.
Right.
You could name any name, and the only thought they had was, he's hack.
Right.
He does the joke about your mom, whatever.
Airplane food.
Right. And then you go, and you see some people who are just masters at it, and you really, I got so inspired, and that's when I realized, I got to start writing. Improv is so throwaway, and no matter how funny it is, it doesn't translate the next day, kind of thing.
I bet the improvers were more open-minded to the comics than the comics were to improvers, but I could be wrong.
I think you're right, because comics totally resented.
They resent everything.
That improvers didn't have to write
stuff. Didn't have to write stuff, and would usually get bigger laughs, mm-hmm. but...
It's like doing card tricks.
Yeah. No, there was a lot of...
Right.
But then it was great, too, because, there was the Improv Comedy Club. They had a branch in Chicago, and then there was this other club, the Funny Firm. And they realized, we got to have comedy troupes. We got to have an improv group, because it's financially, everybody wants it.
Oh.
It was, improv was blowing up.
Right.
And so all the clubs wanted to get in on it. And so I was on those clubs' teams as well. And then so you would invite hilarious stand-ups to come sit with you. Mm-hmm. And it was almost every single time after those shows, they would be like, I got a total new respect for you guys.
Yeah.
Like, you like how fast you have to be and how like confident and blah, blah, blah. The muscles that you're using are stuff that we don't have. So it was always, I guess that's all part of my ambassadorship.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it was.
I should send you to the Middle East.
I'm available.
You're a regular Jared Kushner.
Yeah.
Jared's about to drop a big peace plane. Give him a few more months.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. We're all.
I think he's got it in him.
Yeah. Right? He does. I don't want to date this podcast, but I don't think I will by saying
it's on its way.
It's still a waiting period. So you were doing all that in Chicago, and then Andy talked to
you. And then you put together a packet?
Yeah.
I put it together an initial packet. I think I met with Conan and Robert Smigel when they were first hiring writers before the show started.
In 93.
They came to a stand-up show that I did, and I talked with them afterwards. So I'd met them that way, and then I did stand-up on Conan's show.
I remember that.
Oh.
I think three times.
Oh, my God.
I remember one of them.
The third time was I had nothing.
Oh, wait, seriously?
Yeah, I mean, like it was one of those things, like I had done it twice. So then I got a call from Frank Smile, like, you want to come do more stand-up? And I was like, yeah. And I hadn't been working on anything.
We need you today.
Oh, no. Someone canceled.
No, so I did. And it went okay. But, you know, at that point, I was already not going to be a stand-up. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
I was already kind of going more into like commercial auditions and improv and stuff like that.
Yeah.
but then after that third and arguably least successful stand-up that I got hired.
Oh.
Maybe at that point, Conan took pity on me and just was like, oh, this guy's not going to be a stand-up.
That's his way.
He's taking pity on all of us.
Yes. Yeah. Man, I did stand-up on the show and it was not good. They called me the day before.
Oh, no.
Yeah, someone canceled and
that's
I went
scary.
In.
I remember watching that set just years later.
Oof.
Something about Socks the Cat.
Wait, what? Yeah. Socks the Cat?
Wasn't there Socks the Cat was some president's cat?
Oh, I don't
Clinton.
Remember.
Clinton? I think Clinton had a
cat. Yeah.
I mean,
Nixon?
All I remember is
Nixon. Nixon seems like he had a cat.
I did a hunk on the Nixon checkers speech of 1952. But yes, so. So then, yeah, was that a big deal to move, like just relocate, or you were pretty fancy?
No, I wasn't pretty fancy. I was, we were about to move to LA. I felt like I was done sort of, I had done what I could in Chicago at that point. And yeah, kind of the plan was to move to LA like in at least a couple months.
Yeah.
And then in classic late night fashion, got the call and like, we need you tomorrow to start.
Yeah.
It was like, we need you tomorrow.
Yeah. I got and it was Thanksgiving week.
Oh, my God.
Like, wow, and I was like,
you had to work on Thanksgiving Day.
Yeah, but like, get out there Tuesday. It was crazy.
That's crazy.
But it all worked out.
Yeah.
I was so enormously thankful for it.
You came in, and I think you had a sketch that you were in that you wrote. Like within 2 days.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was
what?
Really. Yeah. No, it was. We were all.
I would have been so mad.
You go back and watch it. It's not worth it. But.
I remember the sketch. You were a reindeer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does not hold up. It's also like 8 minutes long. Like I watched it at some point and I was like, oh my God. Like it was so long.
Go back then.
Yeah, we've talked to other people about that.
About the early and
it was like
earlier.
can it be longer?
Right.
Yeah.
I sent a sketch around, all the writers checked it out. It was an 8 minute sketch with Dippy the Hippie from 1993 with Charlton Heston in it. And it was 8 minutes and I think everyone was just couldn't even wrap their brains around something. Because, you know, everything's so, it's like tight. It's got to be tight.
But that's true. Everything does need to be tight. This was not. I remember doing some sketch and it was all me. It was me talking to Conan at the desk.
Mm-hmm.
I was a page, like, you know, a page with, I don't know exactly what my problem was. Just a dumbass page. And we started doing the sketch. And the crowd instantly hated it. And I just remember, like, in my head just going, 9 more pages. And it was just lonely.
I think all the writers were crying. Because it's one of those things where it killed and everyone loved it.
Yeah.
Or it wouldn't be on the show. And we're like,
I remember a few things like that where it's like the crowd's gonna go nuts and
you're we'll already
find out
planning
of this for 10 years yeah. And then
you're planning for it to come back tomorrow.
Right, yeah. Gets nothing.
Oh.
It's funny because everyone is like tries to be in your head and knows.
It's just like you look over at like at the cue card guy and what he's holding is just like this 5 foot thick stack of cue cards. It's just like, oh, can't we just cut it now? But the crowd was like, they just not only didn't like it, they were like right. offended by the character.
Right.
I think they thought I was like mocking like mentally challenged yeah. people.
Right. I remember this sketch and yeah, Tasu was just like this particular character you played and it didn't.
It was the arrogant dumbass.
Right.
Yeah.
Which was.
Just a dumbass who's super arrogant.
Right.
And it came across completely not that.
Right.
And I, like, even like the first line, whatever it was, and like no one laughed, and you could even hear just like, oh. Like from this one person in the crowd. And that's when I was just like, nine more pages.
Is this going to be on the website?
I don't know.
Now, please.
No, you know what I was wondering?
Make people work for finding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're putting stuff, going to put stuff on the web. And are there things where you're like, oh, you know what? I wish that was online because I'd love to show that to, I don't know, if your children or whatever. But because something you'd love to see again. It doesn't have to be involve you at all.
Well, you're catching me off guard. There's plenty of things.
Of course. It's very hard. It's impossible to think of things.
John Glazer sent me a couple sketches that he and I did.
Yeah.
And I did not even remember doing them. And I was just like, these are funny.
Yeah.
But like literally.
There's such a volume.
Yeah.
Business.
Not even did I like it come back to me as I was watching it.
Yeah. Right.
No,
right.
I was like, oh, wow.
That doesn't even sound like
things.
Us.
Because it was such a volume business and you were there for crazy like 18-hour days and then go home to real life where there's all sorts of demands and stuff happening too.
Right.
So like my brain just decided, I don't know, it was just, which is maybe why I loved improv so much. It's just like I can't store stuff, but I can.
Right. Yeah, it's not the way your brain. Yeah.
Right.
It's like move on.
I was so happy to be on a show with cue cards because it was like no memorized lines because I was always like, if I could just see one or two words, then I'd be like, I know the line.
Oh, cool.
You know?
Yeah. It's so funny. I rarely go on IMDb, but I went on IMDb for you just to read about some of the shows you've been working on. And then it listed a long list of all the characters you played. And some of them were hilarious.
Oh, I wish
some
you
of
could
them,
read those right now.
I could pull them up. Some of them are really funny. One was just, a lot of them
I
are.
I just love the names of characters. Too.
Well, a lot of them start with the name.
Bad Doctor.
Wait, here we go.
Uncomfortable Salesman.
Dr. Two Thumbs.
There were a lot of doctors. Here's one called Audience Member. That's pretty memorable.
I will say, being in the audience was my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Just yelling at Conan.
Yeah.
That and Joe's. Hey. You should put up all of the.
Oh, the Joe's are going up.
Joe's.
Someone. Oh, my son, Matt, watched some of them and loved them.
Those, I hate to watch myself. And
is that true?
Yes. And when I do watch myself, I usually cringe and just go like,
really?
How? Oh, no.
I don't think
everybody,
I'm alone.
Yeah.
No, of course not.
However, but like I was watching, like Joe's Pub, and I don't know, like I'm not saying they're that funny, but that makes me like laugh.
They're
still
really funny.
Watching it.
They're really funny.
They're so just rude.
And you wrote there's the little intro song which you wrote, which is, it's the intro and outro. And it's just fun times and friends at Joe's. And then it's this vicious assault on Conan for 4 minutes.
Yeah.
And then
it's so
the outro
vicious.
Song.
It's just so vicious.
And you're like the stealth weapon. You're the, you're this patron in the last stool at the back of the bar who comes in and just demolishes them at the end. Yeah.
Brutal. Those really make me laugh.
Those are really funny. Here's some characters. I'm sorry. Stop me at any time. The last undecided voter, Jesus. Untreatable gonorrhea dancer.
See, no recollection.
Okay.
But it sounds like something I would.
Yeah.
It sounds douchebag.
It's in your wheelhouse.
Douchebag state student.
That's the guy, that's the picture that hangs up in the lobby.
Oh, that really?
That was Grandpa Douchebag, the founder of Douchebag University.
Oh, now see, okay. Oh. Member of I don't know what that is.
No. That should be, I mean, I was, but That bit shouldn't be remembered.
Okay. How about this? Man with nightclub in pants.
The nightclub was in your pants?
It was in his pants.
I believe that was something I wrote, and the nightclub was in La Bamba's pants.
Oh, okay.
Hmm.
Pretty sure. Damn it. This is,
we need to write to IMDb.
We have to correct all of this.
And ladies, the nightclub is in La Bamba's
always
pants.
In the pants.
Were you, because, I mean, there are writers of all styles, but were you somebody who wrote better when you were kind of pitching a character that you were going to play, or do you feel like...
I'll tell you this. When I first started, like, God bless Conan for bringing me in, and then I think it was, for a lot of us, the patience, because he is a phenomenal writer, and he had such a phenomenal writing background prior to that. And he was, you know, I watched him for 17 years just at rehearsal, take a script, and within 30 seconds, edit it and whatever, and rearrange it
with a scalpel.
Right. And just like, oh, like when I first started, I would say for first couple of years, I could not write for anybody else's voice. Except my own. And so, like, God bless that there was a chance to do stuff for yourself. I could come up with jokes for desk pieces and stuff like that, but to really put stuff in Conan's voice or even a different character's voice was a real challenge. And I remember, like, giving myself an assignment one year, like, after, like, a year and a half or 2 years, where I'm just like, do not write anything for yourself. Just, like, take 6 months and only write, for other people. And only write for Conan. Like, it was like a
really intentional.
And that was like the beginning of like really me. Like, that's like, I felt like my grad school for comedy writing, like, started there. And that's when I started using Mio a lot. That Asian guy and stuff. Like, I found people that I could write for.
Right.
And Joel.
Joel.
And stuff like that. And some guys in the band. But then it was like, it was a challenge. It was intimidating to try to write or put words in Conan's mouth that weren't just straight man.
Super hard.
Super hard. But occasionally it would work. Like, he would see something and be like, oh, great. Like, I get to say this.
And get the big laugh.
Right. And that always felt good. And that became, I think, an ongoing challenge to me. And I just am so thankful that I was paid.
Right.
Like, during that whole, like, process. I felt I was always like producing and always supplying the show with stuff, but I know that they were also being very patient with me too. Because if I were a host, if I had a show, I would want a team of people who had my voice locked.
Right.
And then if there was anything left and they wanted to dilly-dally around with Big Ears and Preparation H.
Right.
God bless them.
On their own time.
On their own time. But I would want, you know, 15 people who can all write hilarious things for me to say and do.
But I guess so. But I think maybe it was also just such a volume business. And it's like, if you had something really funny and it was for yourself, it's like, all right, this takes care of 4 minutes in the middle of the show.
Right. Well, no, and there were those spots, which
I
was so thankful for.
Right.
And that's why there's that list that I don't even remember, like, who those people are.
But, right.
Because I was, I mean, like, as you said, like, in the room, like, I can come up with anything to fill 4 minutes.
Right.
But rarely is it well written with three different strong voices.
Strong characters. Right.
I mean, it is now.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Now the scribe is just, you know, every muse is in my head.
With pen and paper. One of my favorite late night panic situations, I don't know why I remember this one, because there were so many of them where it was 9 p.m., we had eaten dinner, and it's like, we need something for tomorrow, and we're all just sitting there staring at each other. But this one I always remember, it seemed extra dire to me in my head, and we're all sitting there, and it's 9 o'clock. I think it was like 9:12 p.m., and you came in with the kayak guy idea. I don't know. I don't know if you had seen that footage of a guy going down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
A snowy mountain.
I had never seen someone kayaking down a mountain before.
No, none of us had.
I had just seen it, yeah. And that was one of those times where it just like, I have something.
Yeah. So you were just like, oh, I'm going to be a guy who runs, gets mad, runs up the stairs, and then I'll cut, I'll get in a kayak and then cut. It was fully formed like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's why I remember, because you came in, pitched that, and then showed the clip, which, and it was like,
that's incredible.
It was a 2-minute meeting. It was like, yes. It was like, yay, McCann has done it again.
Woo.
Savior.
You all put him on your shoulders.
And then that, I don't even know how many times I was on, but it was so fun.
Quite a few.
They were very funny. And then you did it in Chicago.
Yeah.
Where in a giant Chicago, the Chicago Theater. So, the whole bit is you literally have to run. Well, in 6A, you had to run back upstairs. Or no, you had to run down and get back, come in the side door.
Yeah, I mean.
Whereas in Chicago, I guess you had to run down.
It's really, I think, mostly fun for the live audience.
Yes.
Because they're realizing the amount of the distance that has to be covered.
The physical exertion involved. Yeah.
And the Chicago theater was like 6 flights of stairs. And I think running outside on the sidewalk and like security, like holding doors and stuff like that, which was really fun.
I think if you were watching it, you get it because you would be exhausted.
So all of that was happening live? It wasn't a pre-tape?
It was all live.
Yeah,
it was
wow. Because that's, that's a lot to film too and hope that everything goes right.
Right. I don't know if we ever pulled it up like in afterwards. Like if you got way late in the hallway or something. It was kind of fun to watch Conan spread, like just talk and talk, waiting for you to come in. That was part of it.
Well, because then it started involving, like there was one I know, like where I came back in dressed as a woman, like there was costume changes.
Okay.
There's one like I came back in.
On a bike?
Just pretending to be a woman. I don't know. And then he was like, I know that's you.
Oh, boy.
And then then the woman ran up and jumped.
Right, right. Yeah. Bungee jumped off a bridge.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to put those on.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
Those, Joe's Pub.
Joe's Pub, definitely.
Party in the trousers.
But not the gonorrhea dancer.
I'm curious. Oh, no,
the gonorrhea dancer sounds potentially.
Was it curable gonorrhea? No, I don't remember.
No. I wish there was such a thing.
I thought gonorrhea was curable. Are there super strains?
Probably. Yeah, I think there is a super gonorrhea now. That's more popular again because
has a resurgence. They,
yeah,
because like
kids, this generation of kids grew up not caring because so many STDs kind of got eradicated.
Right. It goes
anyway,
up and down.
That's for another time.
Well, I think it now, sure, and then there's this next generation as they look and they're like, oh, the planet's not even going to be here by the time I'm ready for ARP. So I think there's going to be
all the STDs. Yeah, yeah.
Everyone, I think it's going to be just bragging rights how many STDs you got.
Yeah. And then you tattoo them all on your arm.
Talk about a nightclub in your pants. It's going to be amazing.
Nightclub of bacteria.
Ooh.
And various viruses.
That's one for someone out there. Bacteria nightclub.
Right. Or we cut this.
No.
No.
Bacteria nightclub.
Yes, Jesse.
Brian, you have, it's a little bit of a rare distinction of having been on Late Night, The Tonight Show, and then also Conan at TBS.
Is it rare?
Yeah, I don't know if that's rare.
Is it not that rare?
I don't think so.
Yeah,
I'm talking to someone who
has
that.
No, I know.
Conan has been on all three.
Okay.
Andy Richter.
All right.
No.
Brian
Kiley.
Okay.
Brian Stack.
Michael Gordon.
All right, you're right. That was a terrible question.
Your
turn, Swedes.
Oh, no.
You ask something.
Co-hosts are turning on each other. No, you ask. I'm busy on IMDb reading names off the list. That's really creative.
So where are we going?
I think that you were along for the crazy years.
I felt lucky because I always think the most fun is the beginning of a show where you're figuring it out. And each of those shows had, I feel like I came in early enough with Late Night where it was still, there were still 8-minute comedy bits. That,
right.
So there was still a lot of growth and
learning
to happen there. And then The Tonight Show, what a learning experience.
It was a learning experience.
Amazing.
You all grew a lot.
I'm not sure what... We learned. No, that was quite an experience.
We learned not to move somewhere for a job.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
We all packed up and moved 3,000 miles to hang out for a few months. I bought a house.
I rented some house out in Simi Valley.
Smart. God. You knew.
Yep. I'm the smart one.
You were like, hey, you know what?
I don't know if Simi Valley tells me smart.
I don't know.
There's a long commute.
And what did you do during the time between Tonight Show and TBS?
That's a good question.
Well, I was working with Dana Carvey, which was a great thrill and a great just use of different mental muscles kind of thing. But he was doing a sketch show pilot for Fox with Spike Ferriston. Hmm. And it was Dana, Michael Gordon.
Right.
And myself and Spike basically writing a sketch show.
Fun.
Yeah, for a couple months. And it was awesome.
I remember Gordo was talking about that recently, Michael Gordon.
Yeah.
And he said you guys did that. And then you also wrote a sitcom pilot together.
That's right.
Which I didn't know.
What happened to it?
It's just out there in that giant showbiz dumpster.
Did you ever pitch it to anybody? Or?
Well, the pilot was like sort of bankrolled already. It was Tom Werner of Carsey Werner. Right. He had this idea that Dana could be, and this is prior to what we know now, but could be the next Cosby, you know, like America's dad.
It could still happen.
Right.
Yeah, it still could happen. No, but, you know, he had this idea, and it's not a bad idea because Dana's incredibly lovable and funny. So it was sort of a family style sitcom, but like, not too broad, but just really featuring Dana. And it was really fun, really funny. And I remember at the read-through at Tom Werner's house, Ed Asner played Dana's dad, I think. And it was all funny. But then I think Dana ultimately didn't really want to do it. I remember him, like, as we were writing it, he's just like, couldn't we just do one of those shows where you got like five episodes? Like, this would be 20-some a year. And like, I don't know if I want to do that. He's got a great situation where he doesn't need to.
Need to work more.
Right.
Yeah.
That always sounds good.
Like, he can do like five stand-up gigs a year and feel more than.
Wow.
Happy. Low overhead.
That's great.
He's so damn funny.
Oh, he's hilarious. Conan's been doing. I don't know what the project is, but I think they're banking some podcast episodes that they're doing together.
Oh, almost like a are they improvising? Okay.
And, that'd be great.
Yeah.
They maybe tease that on the podcast.
Conan's just like he's just like, Dana's so funny, so funny. And he can't stop trying to do all his bits.
No, that's what I. So that was like between the Tonight Show and the TBS show.
Right.
I was just going to work with Dana every day and. It's just such a man crush. I was just every day. I was just full like top to bottom laughter.
Wow!
And just like it would always sometimes be the same thing every day. It would just be like his what's the guy's name? The guy who used to host with Kathy Lee Regis.
Oh, Regis. Oh, does he do a great Regis?
He's constantly doing Regis.
Oh, that's cool.
And be like, here's Regis doing push-ups. And it was just like. The fact that it was just him doing Regis, which I knew no one would want to see, which was also funny to me.
Yes.
And just like his commitment to just always pushing Regis.
But also, like, once he knows he's got your number, I could see him just.
Oh, my God.
Whenever he wants to make you laugh, it's like, oh, I'll pull out a little Reg. That's always fun.
Yeah. So that's how I spent that time, which was great.
Yeah. And then it was back to the drudgery.
Well, then it was back to like helping sort of frame a new show, which was always great.
Yeah.
And on a new lot where there's
the
new commissary.
New menu, new specials every day, new soups.
Except for Thanksgiving Thursday.
I like Warner Brothers more. Well, you know what? That, and we mentioned this, that the sound stage on Universal was way too big.
Ridiculous.
It was that classic thing of whoever made it, designed it, and was just like, well, you know, it's the Tonight Show. We got to go big. And it's like,
yeah.
Right.
No, that's the last thing. No one cares about it.
Sounds like it was for professional wrestling.
Yeah, it was. It's just wide and just giant space that was not conducive to an intimate TV show.
Yeah, not at all.
Which is what you want.
Right. And I think it was too much of, like when you have that many people staring at you, I think it's, I think it's kind of, you feel this obligation to try to make, how many ever 600 people laugh, and it's, you know, the odds of 600 people all getting the same joke are slim.
Right.
Whereas in a smaller room, like there is kind of a group mind that sort of easily gels.
That's true.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then everybody's on the same page.
You reach a tipping point and then everyone else has to laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, it's something that happens. But in a room that's like that wide, like there's just people that don't even hear the same parts of sentences, and like there's whole factions that are there, you know, like big groups show up.
Right.
And
yeah.
They have their own agenda, and no matter what this part of the room is enjoying, nope, they want to keep shouting at the band, you know, like, or whatever. It just, not conducive to anything. I remember we all walked in to it initially, and we're just like, oh no.
And it's so one of those things
flags.
Where, well, we'll make it work.
Yeah.
If anyone can make it work, we can make this giant airplane hangar work.
Did you do characters on The Tonight Show, Brian?
Not many, but we did some. I remember I was the one-man flash mob, and this speaks to the enormity of that room.
Yeah.
It was a one-man flash mob, and it was just exhausting trying to work that room, like as this one jackass running around.
Right.
Like, I don't know, trying to get a wave going, but just with myself, but like having to run section to section.
Right.
And it was, I was just out of breath, and it was just one of those sweaty, otherwise it would have killed in the small.
Yeah.
Well, it's true. We on our own, jettisoned all this stuff we did on late night. And it was kind of like, well, but it was weird. It was like we cherry picked some things we brought along, but then a lot of things, bits that were super popular, we're like, oh, let's just try to come up with new stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Which I think that maybe there was a lot of thinking or even overthinking about, oh, well, you're on an hour earlier.
Yeah.
Do you have to, you know,
is
will some of this
audience?
Stuff not play?
Yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Are those people alive an hour
exactly.
earlier?
Exactly.
Yeah, that never made sense to me.
Right.
But there was a lot of network, like executive behavioral scientists.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And also the
focus group.
I think also this conventional wisdom of yes, the audience at 11:30 being very different from the audience at 12:30. I think that went back years, that kind of, you know, well, Letterman was much more, you know, out there versus Johnny. So
yeah,
I think carrying that through.
Yeah. Like you were now having to
our time
appeal to centrists at the 11:30
hour. It's true.
Yep. Yeah.
Now look at it. Any time slot goes. Anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because no one watches TV on TV.
Right. I wonder what they're doing with that space now. I wonder what it's used for. It's probably like
a
farmer's market on Saturday.
Didn't Chelsea Handler use it?
She
after
was
you
in
guys
there,
did?
Yeah. And we Conan shot some like shower scene with her, and I went over with him, and she had basically roped off, taken a third
made
of that
it
studio, and turned that into her studio, and the rest of it was just. Continue
storage.
To store airplanes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so.
I think I heard it's like now divided up into like different news.
Oh, really?
Studio.
Oh, wow. That sounds, it's finally, it's a good match.
But it was a good looking building.
Oh, very, from the outside.
Oh.
Grand. Yeah. It really was. It was built just for the show.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was great proximity to the parking garage.
That's important.
On the few days it would rain, you wouldn't have to worry about getting too wet because it was really just about a 10-yard jaunt from garage to door.
And then off to Simi Valley.
A quick 2-hour commute through traffic.
Were you guys working, I mean, was Was it crazy hours again when the Tonight Show started?
No,
you were just...
I swear, I...
9 to 5.
Literally something about leaving New York and
I know that. I know the reason.
LA. Like the... Oh, okay, what?
I think there was a legitimate reason, which was the show was now owned by Conoco as opposed to NBC or something.
Right.
And when they started seeing like, oh, if we keep people late and we have to buy dinner for everybody.
Oh my God.
So like, let's let people leave before dinner.
You know what?
Is like legally due.
That rings.
That's great.
I believe that. I think that's what happened.
That rings a bell.
Yeah. Which made that, like, there was no benefit to staying
so late.
That was
a bad... I mean, you just hear about habit, other shows where it's like, well, no, we pump all this stuff out and we're home to see our families and have dinner. It's like, wait a minute.
We're all with rats.
We're at the wrong show.
But that worked for me because then everyone would be angry and tired. And then if I had any energy and put a box on my head, people would be like, yes, box on head, let's go home.
10:30, let's do it. Oh, no, New York was half the time we'd finish dinner at like 8 p.m.
Yeah.
You know, if dinner was delayed or something, you know.
Yeah.
And then it's like, all right, meeting in 20 minutes.
Oh, that would have infuriated.
Oh, can you imagine? Yeah. You would not. Oh, it was bad.
I'd be like, get your shit together.
Yeah.
Start pitching.
Yep. Yep. There's a lot of that too. Oh, well. No, we'd work on Clutch Cargos and those would go late, remember?
Oh, yes. Oh,
because it would be off of news from that day.
Yeah.
So we'd start those at night and then bang out. Like I would take notes and then I just felt so guilty that everyone was there that I was like, okay, everyone just go. And I'd kind of like slam it all into an awful first draft and send it off to Robert Smigel in New Jersey for him to check out early in the morning. But and then everyone's back in early in the morning. We have to work on the second version. Ugh. All these insane rewrites all day. Crazy.
But fun. I enjoy that
fun.
Sort
yeah.
of.
Yeah, I was very excited.
I enjoy that schedule of just, I really
the
do enjoy like show has to start at 5 or whatever your taping is.
Yes.
I really enjoy it because I think that really helps that time. Like these shows, late night shows, have that sort of just raw feel. If any of it, like that was one of the problems with the LA studio for the Tonight Show.
Right.
Just too polished.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, like. I do think these shows really get a little boost from everyone watching, knowing that
it was all just
it's a little rinky dink,
yeah, and it's thrown together, and this is what we could do
in
one day.
Then it's the underdog, right?
It's like wow, they pulled that off,
right?
I always thought of it like you're putting out a daily newspaper, and it has to hit the newsstand, and the rewrites for live sketches. And then you'd have to redistribute it and get it on the cue cards and then rehearse it again. And the crowd's waiting to come in. And it used to be, you get used to it after a while. But the first several months, I was like, I'm going to wet my pants. It's so terrifying.
Were there
so
times
terrifying.
Where you had to hold the show? I mean, did it
go
late?
But, yes. And Conan and Jeff Ross, the executive producer, would have none of it. And I was like, well, you know, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
The warm-up guy does another 10 minutes. But no, it was we started at 5:30.
Okay.
It was usually Clutch Cargos, which were the talking lip scripts, which were had a lot of bells and whistles in them and graphics. And we'd be rewriting them. Like, right, the crowd would be out there. It would be bad. It would be bad.
Rehearsing them in the control room as the crowd is out there.
Yes, that's
you were
right.
hearing the Big Butts song. I assume they didn't do that back then. Yeah.
That song had not come out yet. Otherwise, I'm sure it would be part of the warm-up.
That warm-up didn't change since I left.
You did the warm-up.
I did it. But like,
oh, yeah.
But the band played the exact same thing.
It was just... Every night.
17 years in a row, as far as I know.
What was your warm-up style?
Very just, let's talk to the crowd. I had, a couple set gig jokes here and there, but it was mostly just crowd work.
Yeah.
Was my style. I would sort of begin flailing if I had to do more than 20. Because there was...
20 seems like plenty.
20 is a long time.
Yeah.
And I would usually...
Did you whip out Preparation H?
No, I would never allude like to Hive Hooks, you know me.
As yes, it's really me.
Gonorrhea guy. No, it was just all welcoming people to the show. I had my very first warm up I ever did was for the very first HBO Comedy Festival, which was in Aspen or something. I was a stand up at. And I got asked to do the warm-up for the Young Comedians televised special hosted by Gary Shandling. And so there was a version of it that they did at like 5, and then there was the actual live thing going out at 8. And I was the warm-up for both of those. And I did the 5 o'clock one, and I had never done warm-up ever, and no one had spoken to me about anything like how to do warm up or anything.
Really? Just
go out there and do your thing. So I went out there and did my act basically, and people were just like still milling down the aisles and sitting, and no one was listening. And maybe a couple people. And then I remember I go backstage and I'm like, well, I don't know how that went. Like, I honestly don't know what to expect. And then Gary Shandling comes back and goes up to his producer, Jeff Cesario, and he's like, who the fuck warmed up this crowd? It's like, it is death out there.
Oh my God. Oh.
And then Jeff Cesario, it's like so cool. He's like, he didn't say it was this guy.
Yeah.
He's just like,
the guy right behind.
Don't worry, Gary. Don't worry. This is a great crowd. Right. Like, I'll go say hi real quick. But don't worry. And then Jeff Cesario pulled me aside and he's like, let me just give you a quick, rundown of things you should do with warm up, make people feel welcome. Mm-hmm. They've come a long way, let them know that you're shooting, let them know that there's a booth, there's a director in somewhere, and let's test out the mics and all that kind of stuff. So, he sat me down and
would
gave
have been
me,
nice to hear that before you went in.
It would have, but I understand.
Oh, now you tell me,
But then the second, I did it, I was amazed they let me do it for the actual special, but they did, and that was far better. But that was my only learning. And then Sweeney was doing warm up at Conan, and then he became head writer, I got to do it.
Yeah.
And I felt like I had at least, I always have those Jeff Cesario lessons in my head. And then just, some crowd work, fun stuff, some shows, some warm ups, you wish you had tapes of, because you're like, that was amazing. And other ones, just here you go, Conan. Have a great show.
Would you ever? There were times I'd be doing the warm up, and if I had written something that was on the show that night, and I was just like, oh, the crowd wasn't good. I'm like, oh, it's gonna bomb.
Yeah.
I'd have a preview that the bit wasn't gonna do well.
Yeah.
We talked to Jimmy Pardo about lying to Conan about bad crowds. Did you have to do that?
I never lied to him, it was never he never wanted to hear the truth.
No, right.
He never did. But
that was a tough call. I found it to be a tough call, whether to just go, they're great, you'll be great, or go.
I didn't, because if you said they're great, you'll be great, 2 seconds later, he's going to know that's not true. He's going to be like, why were they great for Brian and not for me?
Right.
And so I would always say it's a little tough.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but I meant, to me, it was a judgment call where sometimes I felt like they were on the fence.
Right.
Like, oh, maybe, I think maybe they could care less about me, but they're going to be happy to see him.
Sure.
I don't want to get in his head. Those few scenarios when it's like that. But
But I remember the times where he'd be like, how's the crowd? And I'd be like, it's a tough one today. And then just his face sinking.
I wouldn't do it. I'm sorry. I wouldn't do the show. Yeah.
Right. What do you want me to do?
Right, I'm sorry.
You asked.
I did my C material out there, and no one was buying it.
Now it's your turn.
Well, just every once in a while, with NBC especially, I felt there were certain nights where the audience was a lot of people from the NBC tour.
Yeah.
And had not, like the real crowds, the best crowds are the ones that have ordered tickets, and maybe made trips and everything like that. And I do feel like there was a certain nights where however it works, that audience was filled just with people like, oh, right. And now the NBC tour, we're going to get to go watch Conan taping. And the not knowing the show.
Right.
Yeah.
And you could, like,
you could always tell
you could
that.
Sense that right away and be like, oh, this crowd is 90% people who aren't fans.
Right.
But are happy to watch a show get taped.
Right.
But do not know how to play the game of the show.
Right, right, right.
And don't know the limits of what an audience for our show kind of does.
Right, right, right.
And so, I mean, that's solely, I think it was those nights where I would be like, ah, I think we got kind of a tour crowd.
Touries,
the best crowds, I always thought, was during college breaks.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
You'd get, it'd be packed.
Just like, hardcore so winter break, fans.
Yeah.
And all summer, I'd be like, oh, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
And then you could tell when they went back to, I remember that like right late January, all the college students went back to school, and I was like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
February is going to be rough.
Yeah, February was a very rough month.
Yeah.
And even, like, if you'd be like how many people I watch this show all the time? And you'd get, like, a smattering. You'd be like, oh, no.
Don't be shy.
No, and then, like, for those crowds, I remember I'd be like, you know, whatever. Be like, well,
explain
let me
the
give
premise.
You a little. Here's what we do. We got a bear that masturbates, so watch out for that. We got this and that.
Right, right, right.
But it was just like weird. And people be like, oh, okay. But like, it was like a real like drop off.
Yeah, it would be dramatic. It would literally be almost overnight.
Yeah.
Very dramatic.
Which is, if you've ever done warm up or stand up or anything, such a different feeling to go out there and have people excited to be there versus just people who are curious to be there.
Yeah, no.
And as soon as you go out there and the overall like welcome, even for a warm-up person, is just one of just polite.
Yeah.
Yeah, you instantly know like, okay.
Oh, you know immediately. Yeah.
Immediately.
Get me out of here.
Right.
I know there's certain cliches like, oh, the crowd's never wrong or it's never the crowd, but a lot of times there are. Okay, yes, I accept that notion. But within, there are gradations.
Absolutely.
No question. Every night.
But that's when I would just kind of signal to Steve Hollander, our stage manager, like, get the band out here. Because like everybody likes a live band.
Yeah.
Playing the
Everyone
hits.
Knows how to clap.
Right. And it's just like, I'm going to do nothing but damage.
You know? The longer there's a leak in the roof.
Well, and so Brian, you left Conan at some time between 2011 and 2014, we're not sure.
Right.
But what did you go on to do then?
Well, as is the way I run my life, I had no game plan.
Mm-hmm. But you just knew you had to get out of there.
Well, I had to get out because I was flying back to New York on weekends because my family, my daughter, my whole life was here, so it was ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot.
You were commuting. And
oh,
was
my
it
God.
Every other weekend?
It was every other weekend.
That's brutal.
Wow.
But then there really brutal.
But then there'd be like 3 weekends in a row where I'd go. I remember like flying back just to go to my daughter's piano recital and
in
stuff.
In New
like.
York.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's
no, just
brutal.
Brutal. So I did that for 3 years.
Oh, my God.
And then went back and literally had no game plan. Fired my agent just because.
You were ahead of the curve.
I really was. No, but like, this is how stupid I am. Like, fired my agent because I thought the honorable thing to do would be get rid of your agent and then begin looking for a new agent.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't like, I got this other guy.
Like it's a romantic relationship. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I was just like, it's honorable. Like, I know this isn't going to work for me. So I got rid of my agent. And then it was just like, oh, I'm so dumb. What am I doing?
Now everyone thinks I'm just
No. And then just really, it was a whole new just re-entry into New York show production, like a whole world that I had been completely isolated from because Conan, you are totally in a bubble. You have no idea how any other shows are produced or what even like the business model is of all these shows.
Yeah, that's tough. And then you only have this small pool of people that you know in the business. And so even networking,
especially in New York, I had like nobody. But luckily, like there was all these young people coming up doing shows who were fans of Conan and who recognized me. So I had many opportunities to come in. And so I ended up like first started as a head writer for a MTV show. And then I became like ran a couple shows.
Right.
Great.
And then I became like a producer on another show. And then, I don't know, just like a bunch of things that which is another thing you're very like protected from Conan because it's a long running show. I've just been like in that world of like, oh no, most TV shows last.
Right.
Oh, a few weeks.
Yeah, a few
at
weeks
most.
Or a yeah. year. Or, you know, like this yeah. is like weird. Like so many, like the whole staff happy. Like, we've been here 6 months.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is like, now we know what it feels like. And I'd be like, oh my God. But that's kind of the
that's
reality.
That's the norm. It's that, the yeah, freelancing. It's the norm. And then Conan is the yeah. weird version. Yeah.
But through that just met, so, like, I will say without any like falseness, like 100% happy with the choice of coming back and doing what I'm doing. So it's been incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meeting a ton of great people. And I have, like, I do enjoy the chance to work on all sorts of different kinds of shows. Like, just did that, a show for Netflix for kids last year, which was so fun. And
people love that. Did Andrew Daly work on that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Andy Daly was mm-hmm. the head, like, moron of the kids show. Which was really fun. It wasn't successful globally, and that's what it has to be for Netflix.
Oh.
But that the Americans really loved it.
Yeah, people love that show.
Yeah.
And then you also did that really great, people raved about the debate show.
That was on CISO, and I don't even know if you can even see it anymore
because
CISO doesn't exist.
Yeah,
but that show, I was so proud of, so funny.
I got
just to toot my own horn. Selected like as the New York Times, they were listing the best shows of the year, and they're like, this would have been our favorite, but it was only 6 episodes and it's tied to the election, so we can't include.
Which we're trying to forget about.
But it was that show is called Debate Wars. It's like 6 episodes, I think, hosted by Michael Ian Black. And it's just so funny.
Do you think that could come back?
I know.
Year?
I mean, we've got one coming.
Well, I think that show, like, to me, does not have to be election year tied. I think that could be just a hilarious weekly just show. It is just, it was so funny. That's one of those few things I've done, like, every time I watched it, I was crying laughing, which is
wow. I wonder.
Incredible.
It is somewhere people can watch it.
Yeah.
Was it super, probably super topical, I'm guessing?
No.
No?
No, because it was, it was, that's why I think it could, like when we were doing it, I was like, oh, this is, you know, like Whose Line Is It Anyway became like a show that was on every night at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And
syndicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, Debate Wars could totally be that because it's comedians debating, like, what's better, pie or cake?
Right.
Or, you know, rugs or hardware.
That could be on MSNBC.
No, but it's just like, and it was just like these really, like, in-depth sort of logical arguments.
That they would put together. I love that. Yeah.
And it was just so funny.
Yeah.
And, like, we, you know, and the stand-ups, like, if it were a show that were long-running, like, everybody, I think, would want to play ball at some point. But this was, you know, we were getting the stand-ups who were available, who I had not even heard of, everybody, and they were just killing me.
Wow. Oh, that's great.
That's great.
And Michael Ian Black was just this just snide host, and he was great.
He was perfect.
He wouldn't, like, need to rehearse. He just wanted it to be very,
that's great.
Like, in the moment.
And,
and then, like, I worked with a lot of people at UCB doing the ASCAT show. So I would bring them in to do bits and stuff. So it was all just, that was really fun.
Are you still doing ASCAT a lot?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't since my son was born. Like, after he was born, which is like 2 years ago, I was still doing ASCAT. And then it was one of those nights where I'm on stage.
It's not a great reason to ask to leave a new baby.
Right. No, and I was just like,
can't you lie?
No, and I knew, like, it was a bad time to leave to go do a show.
Yeah.
I don't know. And it was just like one of those things where you find yourself on stage and it's just like, what am I doing?
Right.
Like, I'm always welcome, but I don't need to like pretend I'm 20.
I could see that. Or you're backstage, you know, there's a delay and it's like, well,
Yeah.
Everyone's drinking red cups around you.
I should be asleep.
Right.
Because I'm going to be awoken at 4. No, so that was just, I love ASCAT so much, but I do not do it right now. Nor probably in the future. I don't know.
Well, so, I mean, where could people find your work, I guess, on?
Well, here's what I'm doing.
Give us your home address.
I have, since working on this Netflix kids show, I'm writing a trilogy of books for, and I'm not even sure the age range of kids, but like just funny books, and it's this trilogy, and it's going to be with Penguin.
Cool.
And the first one comes out next February.
Oh, that's congrats. Great.
Yeah, thank you.
So it's incredible. A trilogy.
Yeah.
But what age is it geared toward?
Well, I think it's really geared for parents to read to like 6 to 10 year olds. Or mm-hmm. It's really like
it's geared towards adults as well.
It's I tried to write it in my head in the voice like if Christopher Walken were reading you a story.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so it's just like this sort of narrator voice sort mm-hmm. of telling this tale, so, or a series of tales kind of thing. And it's they're all like it's all based on how dumb animals are compared to humans. Because I was like, you can't make fun of anybody anymore because everyone's so sensitive.
Right, right.
Like, who can you make fun of? I'm
that's
like,
funny.
Animals. And so it's just a real.
Just the male
PETA's going to come after you.
Right. Well, but it's just it's a real just let's look down at animals together.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
Yeah, so it's
and
fun.
It's. Do you know what the other two are going to be yet, or are you just one? Let me get the first
book. I know what the second one is. Second one's done, and then the third one is just, I know what it where it takes place and what it's about, but I don't have, no, that one's a ways off from even being started.
Is it, have a title yet?
The first one's called Wannabe Farms. Mm-hmm. And so it's just all these animals that want to be something like, They just see what the humans are doing, and they try to do it themselves.
Right. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah, you've been so productive.
Yeah.
I'm very excited for those. Very, very.
Cool.
Maybe well, it'll be a book tour or something.
Oh, my God,
do it at farms.
And have Christopher Walken read the audiobook.
Oh.
That would be
or
the
you
dream.
As Christopher
that's
Walken.
A great idea.
No, I want Christopher Walken.
Yeah, don't settle for less.
Yeah.
Don't settle for me. Jesus.
Well, Brian McCann, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is really lovely for me to finally meet you.
Yeah, likewise.
I stare at your portrait every day when I come into work.
And she has to hear about you all the time.
I do hear about you, yeah.
You are talked about.
You are in hushed tones.
Reverent
yes.
tones all the time.
Well, it's Grandpa Douchebag.
Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast, is hosted by Mike Sweeney and me, Jesse Gaskell.
Produced by Kevin Bartelt.
Engineered by Will Becton.
Mixed by Ryan Connor.
Supervising producer is Aaron Blaird.
Associate producer, Jen Samples. Executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross. Jeff Ross at Team Coco. And Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon at Earwolf.
Thanks to Jimmy Vivino for our theme music and interstitials.
You can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts.
And of course, please subscribe and tell a friend to listen to Inside Conan on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or whatever platform you like best.
Ta-da!
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.